was to video, to film, to use cell phones, to get images out to anyone who wanted to see a different view of what was happening in your city.
Yes, so like the main reason was to show the reality of what's going on. ISIS, after they controlled Raqqa and other areas, they started to promote their propaganda. They started like to promote fake news. So we decided to film what's going on to show the people the reality, the other side of the reality of the life. And later on, we decided that we'd not be like only a media organization. So we started to do many activities in Raqqa, like to educate, to aware the people who are living with ISIS control. So we started the graffiti campaigns, poster campaigns, and we ended up doing a magazine, has the same cover of ISIS magazine, to reach out like the largest number of people in Raqqa to educate them about what's going on.
Aziz, before we end, tomorrow Trump and Vladimir Putin will meet. What about Russia's role right now with and against, in both situations, it seems, the United States in Syria?
Yes, so like Russia has been playing like a main role in the Syrian conflict, the same as U.S. Russia, like before the like in 2016, killed people more than anyone, especially in Aleppo, and they're in charge of fighting extremism, and they were killing civilians all the time.
So now the numbers being killed, more being killed by the United States and Russia than by ISIS.
Yes. So the thing right now, like it would be great if we'll have like a non-fly zone. We've been talking about non-fly zones when the revolution then turned to conflict started. So we were asking to have like a safe area to the civilians to go there and stay in case they want to be out of this conflict between all these countries. It's not a local issue anymore. It's like a proxy war between like Russia, U.S., Iran, Hezbollah, thousands of groups, tens of countries are fighting each other in Syria, and every one of them has like interests in Syria. So we want to have like the Syrian people out of it. So right now, like the Syrian people, they want to just survive. All what they are thinking about how to be alive for the next day. And they don't care about these like international conflicts that are taking place in Raqqa and Syria.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Abdelaziz Alhamza is a Syrian journalist and activist, co-founder and spokesperson for Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Chinnarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 16th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 13th through 16th at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. The Northwest String Summit is a four-day celebration of Americana and bluegrass music hosted by the Yonder Mountain String Band. Guests include Green Sky Bluegrass, Elephant Revival, Fruition, Blitz and Trapper, The Shook Twins, and many, many more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Northwest String Summit, July 13th through 16th at Horning's Hideout, 21277 Northwest Brunswick Canyon Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information about the festival, performers, parking, and admission can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dingo, is showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. Miles Davis made his only acting appearance in this film about a jazz trumpeter who dares to realize his musical dreams in the Australian outback. The film also has an award-winning Miles Davis soundtrack.
Did you like the music?
Again, that's Dingo, showing Tuesday, July 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Gotta go now, John, before they take off and leave me. Nice meeting you.
This
This program is made possible by Cable members and support from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, The Rocky Horror Picture Show, every Saturday at midnight, as well as Cable Night every second Thursday. Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast 26 and Clinton in Portland. Schedule an info at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Oregon Reproductive Health Equity Act has passed the state Senate and is waiting for Governor Kate Brown's signature.
Israel has enacted a new tax that targets undocumented migrants, asylum seekers from the Horn of Africa.
And we'll check in live with BARC, a group dedicated to protecting the forests around Mount Hood.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, July 6th, 2017. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Zelos Marchant. A landmark bill, the Reproductive Health Equity Act, was passed yesterday by the Oregon Senate and awaits Governor Kate Brown's signature. The act, currently known as House Bill 3391, requires insurers to cover certain reproductive health services at no out-of-pocket cost to patients. These include contraception, screenings for pregnancy and disease, postpartum care, and abortion. The bill passed the Senate on party lines 17-13, with many Republican senators giving emotional testimony against the bill, including Ben's Senator Tim Knopp.
But colleagues, we learned on the last vote that this whole bill is just really about abortion, because we could have done something different. But when you have somebody that you care about, and I think we all care about all Oregonians, I think it's important that we tell them the truth. You know, and the truth is that House Bill 3391 will force Oregonians to fund, against their will, abortions pretty much for anyone, anytime, anywhere.
Senate Democrats responded that public payment for abortion is, quote, not new, end quote, in Oregon. In the words of Beaverton Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, and the current bill only expands access to abortion and other services. Tualatin Democrat Richard Devlin pointed out that the bill makes, quote, fiscal sense, end quote, and that it reduces public costs associated with unintended pregnancies. The bill aims to equalize access to reproductive health services regardless of income, type of insurance, or gender identity. It also directs the state to reimburse providers who provide these services to undocumented immigrants.
Opioid prescriptions have dropped off in most of Oregon counties, with the exception of Malheur, Morrow, Union, and Wallawa, which have actually had an increase in opioid prescriptions. Data suggests that the health care you receive is based on where you live, with things like economic, demographics, and rural environment being factors. Prescriptions peaked around 2010 with a steady but slow decrease since then. The rate is still incredibly high, roughly four times of what it is in European countries, and has led the governor of Maryland to declare a state of emergency in March of 2017. 33,000 deaths were opioid-related in 2015, which has also quadrupled since 1999. In the early 90s, pharmaceutical companies convinced health practitioners that long periods of dosing patients wasn't as harmful as previously thought. Currently, around 80% of the global supply of opioids is consumed by Americans. Prescriptions have risen by 300% since 1999.
18 men have been arrested in an undercover sting operation. Portland Police Bureau's sex trafficking unit conducted undercover missions targeting online sex traffickers. During the stings, investigators posted online ads on known sex trafficking websites. 18 men between the ages of 21 to 64 contacted police decoys to arrange payments for sexual acts. Portland area hotels assisted the sex trafficking unit during the effort. The suspects have been charged with commercial sexual solicitation and sex abuse in the third degree. Five of the 18 men are from Portland and Beaverton.
Oregon State University and the city of Corvallis have had the Corvallis Multicultural Legacy Center, also known as the CMLC, or more locally known as the Sunflower House. Last March, the center was informed that OSU would be ending its lease with the community center, which hosts several international programs from OSU and the Corvallis community. KBOO's Zealous Marchand spoke to Valerie George from the organization Save CMLC to find out more.
Well, Valerie George, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk to me and our listeners about what is taking place in Corvallis. Do you want to tell our audience about what CMLC is and what's happening between that community center and OSU?
I will. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. The Corvallis Multicultural Literacy Center, also known as CMLC, is a community-based nonprofit learning center which is situated right on the corner of Oregon State University land, and it's been a bridge between the university and the city for the last 12 years, and it's in a historic building, an old house that was built 107 years ago, always painted yellow, so it's always been known in this community as the Sunflower House. And currently, OSU has plans to demolish it because they are building more student housing and then adjacent parking, and so they need that space there, they believe, to build the housing and the parking. And what our community effort, which is called Save CMLC, is trying to convince the university to build around the Sunflower House and actually use it as a model for the way that they design the student housing, and so that it has a friendly interface between Corvallis and the university, which is part of the agreement between the university and the town, that that it would interface well together.
I remember there was a planning committee and had the pleasure of listening to that, where there was much speculation about the size of the parking lot and whether that would be possible to have the dorm structure built around that. What kind of advancements came out of that planning meeting thus far? I think that was early June it took place.
I'm not sure where the planning's at now. I do know that the building itself, the Sunflower House and the adjacent parking, only takes up 5% of that lot, which is going to be developed. There's also trees that are protected, and there's also some kind of wetlands issues, so it's not as if all of that land is usable, but I know they're looking at different possibilities, and I think maybe what it's going to come down to for the university is if it's more financially sound to demolish the building and build, or to build around it. So I think that's what they're assessing right now, because there's, of course, costs contained in either way you go. And we've been working, our Save CMLC group has been working with Restore Oregon, which is based out of Portland, and they have quite a bit of data about the environmental impact of demolishing a building of that age, just because of the materials. Oftentimes at that age, the really high quality materials that were used to build it, it's still a very structurally sound, sturdy building. Everything that's contained within it, and then the demolition, the impact on the environment of any demolition, they say to recuperate all that is lost is about 50 years. So we've been working with them on this, and different environmental groups and all different kinds of community organizations, including the neighborhood association that would be greatly impacted by 300 to 400 students in a single lot at a very busy intersection in the middle of a town, and then their cars as well.
I understand there's been a long-standing partnership between the Sunflower House and OSU. How many programs from OSU, or I should say probably students, use Sunflower House? What kind of programs does Sunflower House host?
Oh, right now, mm-hmm. as the multicultural center,
mm-hmm.
It's a pretty wide variety, because if you're just talking about undergraduate students, there's lots of internships and different ways that the students use the center, including that there's 4,000 international students right now at OSU. And for some of the students, they participate in the INTU program on campus, which is quite costly. And then a lot of the students, like particularly we've been working with the Iranian students, most of them do not come from wealthy families, and they're not supported by wealthy governments. And so they're here on their family's dollar, and so they can't really afford the very high-priced English classes and courses that are offered through the M2 program. And so they take advantage of the free English classes and conversation circles at the Multicultural Literacy Center. And it's also a way not just to have classes and improve their English, but actually to have partnerships. So like through the CMLC right now, there's over 200 active partnerships, and that's between someone who wants to learn a language and someone who is happy to help tutor someone in a language. And a lot of times it's people wanting to learn or practice their English, but sometimes it's someone from the community wanting to learn German. So they find someone, sometimes a student from OSU, who can tutor them in German. So there's all different opportunities like that, but then there's a whole other segment of the population at OSU, which is visiting professors and researchers and those people, and visiting scholars. There's over 550 of those people who have come from all over the world, and they oftentimes bring their families.
That was KBOO's Zelos Marchant speaking with Valerie George from the Save the CMLC. For more on that, check out CMLC's Facebook page.
The TSA has begun testing a new set of requirements that would lead to more rigorous searches of carry-on bags at airports. The change requires passengers to remove and separate more than just their laptop when being screened at security. Passengers could be required to remove and separate other electronics, books, and food items. A report from the ACLU suggests that the increased scrutiny of reading material raises concerns for privacy issues. Historically, reader privacy has strongly been protected by federal and state courts, including the Supreme Court. Individuals reading a self-help book or carrying a private diary may feel that being required to remove those items in a crowd and sending them down a conveyor belt is an invasion of privacy. Passengers already submit to body scans and rigorous security screenings in pursuit of safety, and the ACLU report questions whether the requirement to separate paper items is justifiable. DHS Secretary John Kelly explained that the change is in response to difficulty screening overstuffed carry-on bags. Since airlines have raised prices for checked luggage, more people are filling their carry-ons with more items, leading to difficulties determining dangerous items from innocuous ones on TSA X-ray monitors. To date, the changes have been tested at a number of small airports, but are likely to be adopted nationwide. The TSA responded to reports by emphasizing the language, saying removal of all books from carry-on luggage is not being pursued as TSA policy. It is being considered as a requirement at screening.
Moninda Marube, a professional Kenyan runner living in Auburn, Maine, encountered two bears during an early morning run. Marube, a seven-year resident of Maine, has been training for a marathon whenever he set out on that early morning run. He encountered the bears after he ran past them. As he turned around, he said it took him about 5 seconds to consider all his options. As soon as he showed his back, the two bears charged. He said he knew that standing your ground is considered to be the best option in these cases. However, that just seemed completely impossible to him. He was able to run to a nearby vacant house, and the bears lost interest after he got behind a screened porch.
Yeah. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be partially cloudy with a high of around 81 degrees. East of the Cascades and Hood River will be sunny and clear with a high of around 86. Today in history, Richard III was crowned King of England in 1483. History has not been kind to him. Some argue that he is merely the victim of one of the most successful smear campaigns of all time. He died in the Battle of Bosworth Field, which gave way to Henry VIII and the Tudor dynasty. His body was recently discovered under a parking lot. Oddly, the spot where the king rested was marked with an R for reserved parking since 2000. The quote of the day is from Frida Kahlo, who would have been celebrating her 110th birthday today, saying, quote, "I hope the exit is joyful, and I hope never to return," end quote.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. A union idea to change how New Jersey bids for employee benefits will save $1.6 billion over the next 3 years. Union representatives came up with a new online bidding process, an online auction where drug benefit providers bid against each other. The result is a three-year contract with Optimum Rx that saves $1.6 billion in costs without changing employee benefits. This new system allowed New Jersey to issue a common contract that was then bid on by the providers. The union idea, initially resisted by the state, is now saving money for both union state workers and New Jersey taxpayers. New Jersey Education Association President Wendell Steinhauer says his union is proud to have taken the lead on this breakthrough approach to help union members and taxpayers alike. The unions say this technology created a competitive market for prescription medicines that didn't exist before in New Jersey. In the battle for veterans' health care, journalist and author Suzanne Gordon looks at the Veterans Health Administration and the current attempt to privatize veterans' health services. Gordon says, contrary to the narrative promoted by the right wing and some news media, the VA delivers high-quality health care to veterans.
Probably the best mental health care system in the country, and really delivers amazing primary care in a country that has a real serious shortage in the excellent delivery of primary care.
Gordon says the excessive wait times some veterans experienced in a recent scandal is no reason to privatize the system.
The right wing, in the form of the Koch brothers and other conservatives, and the Koch brothers group Concerned Veterans for America, jumped on what was a pretty small scandal and blew it up into this major, the whole system is broken narrative that the press has been promoting.
Gordon says of the roughly 22 million American veterans, only about 9 million qualify for VA health care. For more on Suzanne Gordon's book, The Battle for Veterans Health Care, check out the WIN podcast at workersindependentnews.com. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren will introduce a single-payer improved Medicare for All bill in the U.S. Senate. Unions for single-payer health care say that support for a single-payer universal health care system has never been higher in the U.S. In the House, 113 Democrats are co-sponsors of a single-payer bill, H.R. 676. Senator Warren is encouraging Democrats to embrace and run on single-payer health care. WIN is brought to you in part by the Amalgamated Transit Union, the largest labor union representing transit and allied workers in the U.S. and Canada, online at atu.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And welcome back. We have in the studio guests from BARC. We have Kim Hack and
Michael Crocta.
Michael Crocta, welcome for our BARC check-in. So, for those who just might not know who the heck BARC is, who is BARC? What are you guys doing over there?
Well,
you're hiking, aren't you?
We're hiking.
On the good days.
And then not so good days, too. Well, BARC's a nonprofit that's been around since 1999, and we work to defend and restore forests surrounding Mount Hood. And we monitor all the projects that are being proposed by the Forest Service and the BLM, and work to articulate a better solution for the forest that emphasizes, you know, healthy forests and communities over extractive industries. And we also have monthly barkabouts, a volunteer ground truthing program where people learn how to go out and survey timber sales and campouts and lots of other things.
Survey timber sales and yeah. monitoring?
Yeah.
So you're like environmental big brother, sort of, or big person, I should say, to be gender neutral.
I like to say that we're watchdogs.
All right. So given that it's hiking season, it's also kind of pollination season. Is there some special hikes related to what's giving a lot of us hay fever right now? Or like whatever?
Yeah, so this Sunday we are going to be out on our monthly barkabout. This theme is going to be on pollinators. The hike itself is actually full. We usually don't cap them, but because we're going into wilderness, we recommend people check out the site themselves. We're going to be going up to Top Spur, and that's up in the Zigzag Ranger District in a beautiful alpine area with the most epic views of Mount Hood. So that is something you all should definitely go out and do, but the hike on Sunday is full. What's next month?
Yeah, next month, and we do these hikes every single month. Next month, there's going to be like an intro to backpacking hike where people are going to learn how to pack and plan for a backpacking trip, and it's going to also take place in an area that's threatened by a commercial timber sale.
Are there like levels of backpacking? Like, is there like the intro is like 10-pound backpacks or like it's
your cat? Like,
okay, that's great. That's great. So tell us some more events that are coming up. Do you know in advance like the next month's events or like?
Yeah, I think let's see on Monday. Next Monday, there's an event. We also have these monthly events at BARC called Ecology Club, where we discuss a different forest-related theme. And on Monday, there's going to be an event focused on bats that's led by a volunteer. And so that's going to be great. And there's also, at the end of the month, a training to do something called ground truthing, so survey timber sales. And then we're having our camp, our annual base camp, August 24th through September 7th, so 2 weeks in the forest, where we're going to do a lot of work to actually collect seeds for pollinator restoration.
What is that process like? You had me at bats, but then you were like seed collecting, and then I just kind of nerded out.
Kind of said a lot there. Well, so I don't know, Kim, did you want to talk about pollinators at all? And
absolutely. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
pollinators, as most folks probably know, are all kinds of different animals, from your honeybee, which is what people often think about, but also your native bees, which range in such diversity in size, in color. We're talking blues, greens, reds, oranges, blacks, browns, just every kind of color and lifestyle. A lot of people think of bees as being social, and some are. Our bumblebees definitely are, but most of our bees are actually solitary. So there are a lot of single moms out there. And then there's also butterflies and moths, as well as hummingbirds. So quite a diversity of pollinators. And so what they do is they bring the pollen from one plant, and if it needs cross-pollination, they bring it to another, because plants aren't mobile. And so they entice the animals to do that work for them. And as a reward, they often get the pollen, which is very protein-rich, as well as nectar, which is, you know, where they get their sugars. So it's a pretty neat partnership that happens, and neither can really exist without the other.
That's amazing. So can bats pollinate? Does that... I don't know if I just conflated that, but...
Yeah, bats do. So fruit bats definitely do. Some more tropical places, you will find that happening. Here we have around 14 or so bats. They're all insectivores, so they eat insects. So they're not going to be visiting the flowers, but so you have to go more tropical places for that.
I was really hoping that nighttime bats were helping with with my pumpkin patch right now. How can people get involved with BARC?
Well,
especially with the seed saving.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so definitely check out our website. We have information about the base camp that we're holding that I mentioned. That's a really great way to get involved if you're coming in. And so again, that's August 24th through September 7th. We're going to be in a timber sale called the Crystal Clear Timber Sale, collecting information that we're going to use to raise awareness about that project. And we're also going to be collecting seeds out there, different seeds that will be planted for pollinator restoration projects by the Forest Service. So you can come and learn how to do that and get involved in protecting the forest and restoring pollinators.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on KBOO and checking back in. We'll probably be seeing you pretty soon, I imagine.
Yeah, see you in the forest.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Today, the animal rights activist group Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE, released a new type of footage from inside an industrial pig farm. Activists infiltrated Circle 4 Farms in Milford, Utah, one of the country's largest pig production facilities. They used newly developed virtual reality cameras to record the horrific conditions for sows and piglets. Much of the evidence flies in the face of claims by Smithfield Foods, Circle 4's parent company, that they either are improving or have improved conditions. Smithfield has not responded to a request for a comment with Cassie King. For more on the story, KBOO reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Cassie King, an organizer with Direct Action Everywhere's Berkeley chapter. Our listeners should know that the following audio contains descriptions of animal abuse. King begins by describing the group's strategy of Open Rescue.
So Open Rescue is going into these places of violence, documenting the conditions in our investigations, finding animals many times who are literally on the brink of death. And when we see that, we feel compelled to bring them to veterinary care and to give them the lives that they deserve. So afterwards, it becomes very, very open because we share their stories. We've documented everything along the way. We show their transition. Today, we're talking about Lily's rescue, so we are sharing videos that tell people to follow Lily's story and see how much she's changed and how much she'll continue to change as she can finally experience being outside, being with other pigs, being with humans who care about her.
And can you just tell us a little bit about Lily and what her life has been like so far?
Sure. Lily was born on Circle 4 Farms in Milford, Utah, one of Smithfield's farms, actually the largest Smithfield farm. And of course, these conditions do not give any individual care to Lily. She is an object to them. So as soon as she is born, she is physically separated from her mother by these metal bars in the farrowing crates where her mother is confined. And all that she can do is try to nurse from her mother. But she has nowhere to go. She has nothing really for her except metal bars and dusty air that smells foul. And that's her whole life until about 3 weeks old, when these babies, like Lily, are separated from their mothers. And for the next few months, they're just, you know, they grow as quickly as possible. That's how the industry makes their money. And then they're slaughtered while they're still technically children. So Lily was rescued before that would happen because she was so injured. Her leg was injured and she was about a third of the size of the other babies. So just, you know, already having trouble getting enough nutrition. And she fortunately did not move on to that next phase where she would have grown until her slaughter date. But that's the typical life that is laid out for her and the other pigs at these farms.
Tell us a little bit about the video that was released today. As specifically, what sort of technology was used and what it shows?
So the video is a virtual reality video, which is filmed with a 360-degree camera, which means that everything the activists saw, any way they turned, you know, you can see that when you click and drag your screen, or if you're able to put on the VR headsets and just turn your head, turn all the way around, you see everything that they saw wherever you look. So it allows people, the general public, to experience what that really is like, walking into one of these farms, seeing the horrendous conditions, and actually becoming part of the rescue. So it's that ability to go inside and feel part of the experience rather than just watching something in regular video footage. And that's provided to us by Condition One, a really awesome virtual reality company who's been extremely generous in helping us bring this experience to the public, providing the cameras and the headsets and doing a lot to help us show the public what's really happening in a way that they would never be able to experience it otherwise.
I reached out to Smithfield. I haven't heard it back from them yet. They were quoted in the New York Times today. Their spokesperson said that the video appears to be, quote, highly edited and even staged. What would your response to that be? How is that even possible with this technology? Or
that's been a claim from industries as long as rescues have been going on. It's the quickest and easiest defense to draw to say, no, 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 this isn't true. This is edited. And really what that reveals is that they see how horrible and problematic the conditions being documented are, which is why they feel a need to say, that's not the case, that's not true, that's horrible. But actually, virtual reality is our response to that. It's pretty ridiculous that they're still making that claim when we now have 360-degree footage showing all the way around this farm, everything that you can see. And I don't know if they think that we brought pigs in to act or what exactly they think, but this is as real as you can see it without being there on the farm.
What we see in this video and what and the other information that activists got from these from this action in particular, it does not comport with what Smithfield has declared they are doing and what they have claimed to be changing in response to criticisms. And can you just go through what some of those claims are, like what reforms they said that they would do and how this evidence contradicts that?
Sure. So notably, Smithfield has claimed to be transitioning from gestation crates to group housing for the mother pigs, so that instead of being confined in solitary confinement, they'll be confined in a group, which is, I guess, slightly better, although it's still confinement. And they say at this point that they've moved more than half of the mother pigs on their company's farm to group housing already. But we've found no evidence of this on Circle 4 Farms, which is the largest Smithfield farm. It sends 1.2 million pigs to slaughter every year from just this farm alone. And within the farm, there are many, many barns, and we've checked many of those barns. So within this entire farm, the largest farm that they have, there's nothing but gestation crates and farrowing crates. So the mother pigs move from the gestation crate to the farrowing crate to give birth, and then they move back, and the process starts again. But their entire life is crate to crate. But we found no evidence of group housing or any plans to move this direction. So it's really, without checks and a way to monitor what's happening on these farms, it's really impossible to know if what they claim is even at all true, if even less than half of their farms have changed to group housing, because there's really no unbiased system in place to check these industries. And so when we see that that's the problem, we feel compelled to check and to hold them to a compassionate standard, which in really, if you're keeping true to compassion and the values that most of us have, it's to not be violent towards animals at all. Some of the things that we found that you can see in the virtual reality video are mother pigs who have been nursing so many litters, just one after another, because that's their whole life, that their nipples are so chewed up and bloody from constant nursing that the baby piglets, when they try to nurse, instead of getting milk, they're literally drinking their mother's blood, because that's all that's coming out of these chewed up nipples anymore is just blood. And then you can see the babies have blood all over their faces because that's the conditions that they're living in. One other striking thing, I think, I've only seen the footage because I was not in the investigatory team, but even in the footage I have a visceral reaction because there are piles of dead baby piglets right mixed in with their mother's feces. There's nowhere else for anyone to go or anything to go. Everything sits in the same crate the entire time that they're there. And it's no wonder then that these animals are so sick and become infected so easily.
I've been speaking with Cassie King of Direct Action Everywhere. Cassie, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
Israel is being criticized by local and international human rights groups for a recent law targeting North African migrants and asylum seekers who entered the country illegally through Egypt. The law, which went into effect in May, requires employers to deduct 20% from the wages of undocumented Eritrean and Sudanese employees, to add an employer-paid tax of 16%, and then deposit the whole sum into a savings account that workers can only access when they leave the country. Critics decry the law as a racist attack on vulnerable refugees fleeing violence and famine. Reports are beginning to emerge of asylum seekers being fired from their jobs by employers who do not wish to pay their portion of the tax. The full impact of the law will not be known for some time. The population of refugees from North African countries has dropped in Israel since the completion of a wall along the border with Egypt. Many have sought asylum in other countries in response to hostility from the Israeli government.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Wednesday, July 5th, 2017. Troops invade West Bank communities, detain civilians, and confiscate solar panels. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Israeli soldiers invaded Wednesday Shu'afat refugee camp north of occupied East Jerusalem and broke into a home before forcing a mother and her toddler out of their property. The soldiers kept the mother and her toddler under the sun without even allowing them access to water or change of clothing for the child while searching their property for 90 minutes, local sources reported. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers withdrew on Wednesday morning from the Kalandia refugee camp north of occupied East Jerusalem after abducting four young Palestinian men following many hours of invasions and violent searches of dozens of homes leading to clashes with local youth. Many local youth hurled stones and empty bottles on the invading military vehicles, while the Israeli army also claimed that some Palestinian fighters exchanged fire with the soldiers. The army fired dozens of live rounds, flares, gas bombs and concussion grenades after invading many alleys and homes in the refugee camp. No injuries were reported. Moreover, Israeli soldiers abducted on Wednesday at dawn four Palestinians in the West Bank governorates of Hebron and Tubas after invading homes and searching them. In the meantime, Israeli soldiers invaded several Palestinian communities in the northern West Bank governorate of Nablus, stormed and violently searched a number of homes and stores, and abducted seven Palestinians. Also on Wednesday morning, the soldiers invaded Khirbet al-Himma village in the West Bank's northern plains and confiscated solar panels, providing the residents with electricity, and initiated searches for more panels to remove them. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, July 5th, 2017, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Jordan Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer, produced, and driven newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories. If you've covered a local event or have audio or video that you want to share with KBOO, we want to hear from you. Call us at 503-231-8032 or contact the Evening News Director via email at newsdirector@kboo.org. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jasmine Moneymaker, Calix Alexander, Sophia Sadie, Grace Ann Smith. The producer is San Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew the Fantastic Olsen. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is myself, Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. And you can also find us on the Facebook and Twitter and also Instagram. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Zelis Marchant.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn take your calls. At 9, it's Pacific Underground with interviews, performances, and real-time coverage of issues affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders in the Northwest. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly kicks off summer with a discussion on comics and how they can be used as tools for social justice. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night.
Good night, Grisanne.
Good night, Matt.
Good night.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to another KBOO News In Depth. This evening, we have special guests in the studio. Tonight, we are featuring the Revolution Choir. They are a group of 20 super fun and energized choristers that sing original compositions about progressive political topics that are on the pulse of our nation. They sing powerful songs in four-part harmony about subjects such as equal pay for equal work, climate change, gerrymandering, income inequality, money in politics, LGBTQ rights, Black Lives Matter, honoring women, and many other important progressive values. They recently opened For Good in the Hood. They are founded and directed by Kevin Levy. Welcome, Revolution Choir and Kevin.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So good to be here at KBOO. Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you for coming. So how long has Revolution Choir been around?
You know, I think we're coming on 5 months.
I'm really shocked about that.
Yeah.
I feel like I think we've talked a little bit about this. I feel like there's got to be several years under your belt so far.
You know, our singers here, like, they just sound amazing, and they're just pulling it together, and just a lot of great friends of mine, and
awesome.
Have great vocal cords.
You're making waves. 5 months.
Tidal chord waves.
So you're going to regale us with a song or two or three. What's the first song?
Our first song we are going to do is Overworked and Underpaid.
All right.
When I wake in the morning, I just lay in bed and close my eyes. 'Cause my
That was pretty fantastic. What's the next song? That was tasty. One.
We can have a Congress with a 12% approval rating and yet a over a 90% re-election rate. And it is rigged so bad that that is gerrymandering right there. A congressman can manipulate and draw those districts so evil that basically it makes them impossible to ever vote them out of office. So we must, if you live in a gerrymandered district, and thankfully Portland does not, but somewhere out there you are listening to this, vote for an independent commissioning district for fair, equal, and balanced voting districts. We are gonna do gerrymandering.
Something. All of you are so powerful. Tell our audience about the performances that you've got coming up. On
July 8th at the Laurelhurst Park, the Revolution Choir will be performing at 3 p.m. and we would love for you all to come and visit us. And you can actually get the invite if you just go to revolutionchoir.com, and there's a direct Facebook invite, or you could just go to facebook.com/revolutionchoir, whoop, and find that invite. And we would love to see you there. It's going to be so fun. There's going to be an opening act going on before us. Resist Sing comes on right at 3, and we are following them, and we would definitely love to see you, and you're getting just a little taste of what we are right now. And July 8th, Laurelhurst Park, if you know where that duck pond is and that little dog park where it's off leash, and you can just go and check us out there.
I think our audience is dying to know whether there are Revolution Choir groupies at this point. I know it's early in the game.
That's a great question. All of you listening right now, you are our very first groupies. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. So, are you writing all the material yourself? Is that right?
Everybody, correct.
Do you have think tank sessions where you get together and you're like, what awful thing happened in the news this time that we need to write a song about?
It's a little bit of both. I love hearing feedback from certain choir members that just will give something off their heart, and then I kind of come home into my garage and late at night pull up the guitar and start writing songs. And
I love that picture you just painted. Deep into the dark of the night after political corruption has happened, Kevin Levy composes Songs of Resistance.
That's right.
That's wonderful. Are there choral openings right now? Do you accept more choristers, or is it a special club? I don't know.
That's such a great question. If you are a first soprano, or if you are a deep bass, we would love for you to contact us. Kevin Levy, I'm the man. Contact me.
Okay. Great. Without further ado, let's dive into another song.
Our next one is Love Conquers Hate.
Don't you know that Black Lives Matter? Lives matter, LGBT.
I'm Zella Zellis Marchand. We're wrapping up a very special in-depth featuring the Revolution Choir. They are performing July 8th at Laurelhurst Park.
That is correct.
By the very beautiful scenic duck pond. and they have an opener who is...
Resist Sing.
Thank you so much, Kevin Levy and Revolution Choir, for taking time to come in and sharing your songs of resistance with our community and our audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the benefit screening of Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, on Friday, July 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years. The film features personal stories of resistance told by victims.